DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
Hello and welcome to Living Planet. Coming to you from the UN Climate Change Conference in Bonn, I'm Charlotte Lomas. Well, the high-level segment kicked off midweek with heads of state and government taking part in the final days of the negotiations.
Meine Damen und Herren, vor zwei Jahren ist etwas gelungen, was wir uns in Kopenhagen noch nicht vorstellen konnten.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel told delegates that current measures to address climate change do not go far enough.
Aber wir wissen, das Pariser Abkommen ist ein Ausgangspunkt.
Combined pledges to cut emissions, as outlined in the Paris Accord, are not sufficient to keep the world to below 2 degrees warming, let alone 1.5. It's hoped that the climate talks in Bonn can spur countries to boost their emissions targets to avoid the frightening prospect of a world that's 3 degrees warmer. Facilitating the negotiations is UNFCCC Executive Secretary Patricia Espinosa, a Mexican politician and diplomat. Ahead of the climate conference, I sat down with Espinosa at the headquarters here in Bonn, the site of COP23, and I asked her if she thinks the 1.5 degree target is still possible.
It definitely is still possible. We are seeing a transformation in many areas of our societies at a pace that we had not imagined just a few years ago. And at the same time, new solutions are coming into the picture. It is possible, but it requires really a very important political will. It requires action by each and every person in each and every society.
And that is the goal here. It's not 2 degrees, it's 1.5.
We need to be ambitious. So yes, I would say we need to go towards 1.5.
Many climate scientists argue we need to get to zero emissions or even negative emissions in the coming decades. Do you think that that is actually achievable?
Well, there is a lot of discussion about new and innovative solutions for that, how to get carbon emissions out of the atmosphere as well. I think that we have to go towards climate neutrality. I think that we have to be open and let ourselves be surprised by new developments. And if we really can find a way of going into a negative emission world, it should be welcomed. It's still not very clear whether that's 100% possible or not, but I certainly applaud all the efforts that intend to bring us into that direction.
And the climate math shows that we will have spent our carbon budget within a decade. Time is running out for us to transition away from fossil fuels. Have we reached a point where we have no choice but to consider other alternatives?
Well, I believe that we need to be open to all alternatives. We need to, however, always bear in mind that any solution has to be reliable, has to be safe, has to really be done in a way that it does not represent a threat to people.
Climate experts say a lack of political will and the influence of fossil fuel lobbyists are the biggest barriers to achieving the goals of the Paris Accord. What is your plan as UN Climate Chief for dealing with these obstacles?
I think that the fact that we have today, less than 2 years after the Paris Agreement was adopted, already 169 countries that have ratified, which is really a record number for a multilateral treaty like this, does show that there is political will, because ratification implies that countries need to really get the agreement of the political forces of all these countries. At the same time, we are seeing also a very rapid development in turning to renewable sources of energy. And this is happening also because the prices of technologies, of other technologies, are going down. So we are seeing now a world where in many countries, in many places of the world, new and renewable sources of energy are competitive to fossil fuels. So I would say that the role of the UN is not really to try to content any specific constituency or community, but it's rather to provide a platform where everybody comes together looking at a very specific objective, which we have in the Paris Agreement, and then try to find solutions where all those different situations really can be resolved and actions can be aligned towards that objective.
The NDCs submitted by countries are not sufficient to meet the global warming target of 2 degrees. NDCs are not legally binding. How can ambition be ratcheted up in time, and how can the UNFCCC ensure transparency and accountability?
And making the Paris Agreement fully operational, which means also that all the machinery that is established under the Convention and the Paris Agreement in order to support developing countries in complying with their commitments in this area needs to be fully in place by 2018. So I do believe that the more the developing world will have access to those mechanisms, to that kind of support from developed countries, we have a better chance of increasing ambition, of having a revision of the NDCs in order to increase the goals. We need to have that anyway by 2020.
So the solution to climate change is really quite simple. Stop releasing carbon dioxide into the air. So why do you think it's so hard for people to get their head around the topic of climate change? And why has action been so slow?
Well, it sounds easy, but it's not really easy. And also, since the Industrial Revolution, the world has developed and evolved in a way that is very intensive in carbon emissions. So it's really a huge transformation. I believe that the very frequent extreme weather events that we are now experiencing in different parts of the world are helping in raising awareness. But now there is an important part that we need to do in order to explain why that is linked to climate change, to global warming. So we need to bring the issue much nearer to the personal life.
That was UN Climate Chief Patricia Espinosa. Well, there's much talk of the effect that CO2 emissions are having on global warming. But one topic that gets far less attention is how this triggers and accelerates ocean acidification. That's because the ocean absorbs about a third of the CO2 released into the atmosphere by human activities. A new report by 250 scientists presented at the climate conference here in Bonn sheds light on this very serious issue, which threatens life in our oceans, from the smallest plankton to the fish we eat. Our reporter Lash Bavanga has more.
Waters like the Baltic Sea, gently lapping the harbour here in Kiel, have sustained life for billions of years, yet it is now becoming increasingly hostile to marine life. Global warming, plastic pollution and overfishing are challenges many are aware of. Now, new research shows another threat must be added to that depressing list: ocean acidification.
So the photo that you have on the screen there is of the mesocosms. So these are like our test tubes.
Mesocosm is a floating laboratory in the sea, basically.
Yes, it is. So we enclose the water. So we take it's kind of like a plastic bag that's lowered down. So we simulate changes in the seawater chemistry and look at how the...
Dr. Alana Paul is a researcher at the GeoMar Centre for Ocean Research in Kiel. She and her colleagues have spent years looking at what happens to life in the sea as pH levels dip below 7, the threshold for turning the waters acidic.
And then how the whole ecosystem responds to these changes. A good example is coccolithophores, or calcifying organisms, because when you lower the seawater pH, they have to use more energy to build their calcium carbonate shells, because these dissolve in seawater that has a lower pH.
Here's how it works. Oceans are carbon sinks. They naturally absorb CO2 from the atmosphere. When CO2 is dissolved in water, it forms carbonic acid. Not a problem under normal circumstances. But the CO2 levels in the atmosphere are no longer normal. A recent report by the World Meteorological Organization warns that 2016 CO2 levels surged to a record high. As a result, the seas absorb far more CO2 and acidification accelerates too fast.
What we see is that some organisms completely lose their competitive fitness. They are kicked out of the system, so we lose these species from the ecosystems, meaning that biodiversity goes down, some of the ecosystem functions that we all depend on will decline.
Professor Ulf Riebesel, also from Kiel's Geomar Centre for Ocean Research, is the lead author of a new report into ocean acidification. It's the culmination of the 8 years-long bioacid research programme involving more than 250 scientists. Their findings will be presented at the latest round of UN climate change talks in Bonn this month. Because cold waters can dissolve more CO2, the creatures worst hit by acidification are Arctic and Antarctic water shellfish, like clams, mussels, sea urchins and snails, explains Riebesel.
These waters will become corrosive, meaning they have conditions where calcium carbonate shells and skeletons just start to dissolve. A lot of organisms will not be able to survive under those conditions in the Arctic, in the Antarctic. Biodiversity will drop down strongly in the polar areas.
Here's an experiment you can do in your own kitchen to understand what happens to a calcium-based clamshell in acidic water. Your kettle or coffee maker might have built up a layer of lime scale in the bottom. Think of that as your clamshell. You add an acid descaler to get rid of it. That's your increased ocean acidity. The lime scale, or the clam's shell, disappears. Good for kettles, deadly for clams.
But ocean acidification has serious consequences outside of the polar regions as well. Coral reefs struggle to build their skeletons in acidic waters. Some types of plankton that need protective shells suffer. And human food, like fish, is also under threat, explains Ulf Riebesel.
We have tested cod in particular. We have tested juvenile cod, how they respond under oceanification. What we've seen is that their survival has decreased by 50% if they're exposed to even moderate increased CO2 concentrations. The future populations of cod may be down to 1/4 to 1/12 of their size today, which would have massive impact on cod fisheries.
Scientists here in Germany and elsewhere will continue at pace to understand how we best can slow the acidification of the seas. According to the bioacid study, things are not looking good. It concludes that even if the world manages to meet the Paris Agreement and keep global warming below 2 degrees, this might still not be enough to stop increasing levels of acidification. Lars Bevanger, DW, Kiel.
Keeping global warming to well below 2 degrees demands urgent political action, particularly from the world's top three emitters, China, the US and the EU. Despite a strong representation here from many of the 196 countries and the EU, the presence of the official US delegation has been minimal. Which is not surprising since earlier this year President Donald Trump announced the US would withdraw from the Paris Accord. But while the Trump administration is out, much of America is still in. An unofficial delegation of US states is present at COP23, with California Governor Jerry Brown emerging as a leading figure on climate action. He, along with other prominent US politicians and business leaders, has launched America's pledge, "We Are Still In."
That America's in. We're in the Paris Accord. We have to keep the temperature below 2 degrees centigrade increase. And we're going to do that not with the federal government, because the federal government is on holiday with respect to climate change. But California isn't, New York isn't, the states of Washington, Oregon, Virginia, New Jersey. We represent almost half of America. And then in addition to the states, we have cities, hundreds of cities. We have corporations, we have universities. So there's a large part of America, well over a majority, that is committed to serious climate action.
The sole US official side event at COP23 focused on promoting fossil fuels as a solution to climate change. It was rather emblematic of the US administration's isolation on the issue of climate change, as the only country in the world to reject the Paris Agreement. While the rest of the world looks to renewables, Trump is promoting what he calls beautiful clean coal. The US has teamed up with the Canadian government to work on a coal-fired power plant that captures CO2. Carbon capture and storage, or CCS, is a controversial topic because it has the potential to extend the life of the coal industry around the world. But is it a good idea when the world is trying to wean itself off fossil fuels like coal? In Ottawa, our reporter Sian Griffiths finds out.
In the woods on the outskirts of Ottawa is a Canadian government laboratory. Here, researchers have constructed an experimental coal-fired plant which uses oxy-fired pressurized fluidized bed combustion, or oxy-PFBC. It's the latest in carbon capture technology, but before I begin my tour, health and safety first.
A hard hat and safety glasses.
Sure, thank you. Bill Follett, the program manager, leads me into the plant. He and a group of other rocket scientists from California are leading the joint Canadian-US oxy-PFBC program. They're experts at generating the most amounts of power in the most effective way. We walk into a large room with what looks like three large laundry bags full of coal below massive metal bins, the front end of the oxy-PFBC system.
That's where the coal gets unloaded in there, and then it gets conveyed pneumatically up into the upper floors of the building.
This pulverized coal is more than 65% pure carbon. Carbon dioxide is the oxidized form of carbon. Next, we're off to see the combustor upstairs. It's housed in a very tall, very bright orange, rocket-shaped pressure vessel. In fact, it all looks as if the Cape Canaveral rocket launch pad has been squeezed into a three-story building. Next, we see how the CO2 will be captured. Leading from the top of the pressure vessel are metal tubes and pipes which extract the CO2 from the combusted coal. Potentially, this captured CO2 could be commercialized, sold on for use in the oil industry, or used to make chemicals or fertilizers. The combusted coal would be used to power turbines and generate electricity. Though there's still more testing to be done, full-scale coal-fired plants like this one could be rolled out in the next 5 years across Canada, the US, and beyond. Canada is moving quickly to phase out coal-powered plants by 2030, but point out that this new technology can use different types of fuels, such as solid waste and biomass. According to the Canadian government's own figures, greenhouse emissions have fallen, but only slightly. Canada, the report projects, won't meet its own 2030 climate targets, not without further investments into public transit, green infrastructure, and clean technology. In another recent report, the International Energy Agency says that carbon capture and storage, or CCS technology, can play a crucial role in reducing fossil fuel emissions to help meet Paris Accord targets to limit temperature increases to below 2 degrees Celsius. Anything that will prolong coal's future will be music to the ears of U.S. President Donald Trump.
My administration is putting an end to the war on coal. Going to have clean coal, really clean coal.
The U.S. is the world's third biggest coal producer. Trump has said climate change is a hoax and that he won't be holding the U.S. to any of the Paris climate targets, having abandoned the accord. But coal is in decline due to economics and the rise in cleaner alternatives. A decade ago, coal met nearly one quarter of America's energy needs. Now it meets just 15%. Increasingly, the world is transitioning to the use of renewable energy. Aaron Flanagan is the head of climate and energy policy campaigns for the Pembina Institute, a Canadian environmental think tank.
When we look at coal and coal-fired power, we look at a broader view of where the world is going and the Paris Agreement in particular. So the Paris Agreement on climate change, which we as a country have ratified and continue to say that we support, requires mid-century decarbonization in Canada, which means we need to go to near zero emissions.
Can clean coal get us there? And can coal be clean?
Well, I think it depends on who you're asking to define the term. A lot of times we're talking about, you know, what are we putting into our gas tank or what's going into a power plant, but there are these other pieces as well. So there's the extraction, there's transportation.
That's where things do get tricky with coal. Mining spews tens of millions of metric tons of carbon dioxide and methane, an even more potent greenhouse gas, into the air. While many countries in the West are working towards a phase out of coal, this will take longer in developing and emerging countries, and the 2015 Paris Accord makes allowances for this. China is the world's biggest producer of coal, responsible for nearly half the world's supply. A whopping 70% of its energy demand depends on coal. It's also the world's biggest emitter of carbon dioxide. That's because the country is developing at breakneck pace, as Xia Xiang, the country's economic and commercial affairs officer in Ottawa, explains.
The energy is the food for industry. China is the factory of the world. In comparison with the developed countries, China is at very early stage of the industrialization or even the globalization.
China is investing heavily in renewable energy, but Mr. Shang says it's just not possible to switch off coal completely in the near future, which means cleaner forms of coal, like CCS, are very attractive to the Chinese, a potential market for the OxyPFBC creators. But climate expert Aaron Flanagan says, ultimately, it's the bigger picture that counts, a decarbonized picture.
You know, we really need to look at the life cycle of the potential environmental footprint of the fuel sources that we're using.
Back at the CCS laboratory, Bill Follett says it doesn't need to be one or the other. He also supports a decarbonized future, but sees OxyPFBC as a transitional means of getting us to net zero emissions.
Yeah, I'd like to see everything weaned off of fossil fuels as well. And I think that eventually we need to get to all renewables. However, it's a long process, and it takes a long time to get there.
Shan Griffiths, DW, Ottawa, Canada.
While a world of fossil fuels might seem like a distant future, scientists warn we're running out of time to curb emissions if we want to avert the worst impacts of climate change. There's only so much CO2 we can release before we push the global temperature above 2 degrees, what scientists call our carbon budget. A new study published this week suggests we're blowing that budget faster than we thought. The report says emissions for 2017 will spike by around 2%. At COP23, I spoke to one of the world's leading climate scientists, Kevin Anderson, Professor of Climate Change at the University of Manchester.
A new report that measures the carbon emissions for 2017 has been released this week. Could you tell us a bit about what this report says? I understand it's not good news.
No, it's not. This is the Global Carbon Project, as it's called. And it's a group of scientists and academics around the world who like playing with numbers. And they collect together all of the emissions data, so basically how much fossil fuels, how much coal, oil and gas, and other sources of carbon dioxide. And from that, they can work out how much carbon dioxide has been put in the atmosphere. And their latest data has shown that after the last 3 years, which have been almost stable, in other words, plateau, at a very high level, that this year emissions have looked like they've gone back up again by about 2%.
And what's the cause for the increase?
Some people will argue that China are the main cause of this increase because they're burning a little bit more coal. And this depends how you look at the issues. I own a MacBook made by Apple Mac. That was made in China. So is the increase in emissions due to their coal use the Chinese fault, or is it me for buying the MacBook that was probably made using energy powered by coal? So I think we have to unpick these things. So we know it's the coal use in China. I don't think we should necessarily say it's all China's fault. Many of us in the West have basically what we call offshored our industry. We've closed down our industry and we expect poorer countries with lower labour rights and lower pay for those people and lower environmental conditions to make these goods for us. And then we blame them when the emissions go up. I think that's morally suspect.
And could you talk a bit about the years that it plateaued? What was the cause for the plateau?
The cause of the plateau was, again, primarily China. China was burning less coal. Very rapidly, they closed down quite a lot of these very polluting power stations. But what they're doing also at the same time is to make sure they drive their economy. So they're getting more sort of bigger power stations away from cities, and they're again using coal. But it's also fair to say that China is also building lots and lots of renewables, and indeed some nuclear as well, which is whatever people may think is very low carbon.
Do you think we can live in a world without fossil fuels, and what would that look like?
Many people in the world live without much use of fossil fuels. Most people in the world use very little fossil fuels. They're primarily used by a small minority of us. So for a lot of people, they might see some changes, but actually, to be honest, I don't think they necessarily have to be too profound, those changes. But I think for the sort of wealthier parts of the world, I think we are going to have to see, particularly the wealthy people in the wealthy parts of the world, I think we'll have to see some very significant changes to how we live our lives. Now, that's not maybe the majority of people in most countries, but say the top 20 or 30%, I think they will see some big shifts in what they would call their status. So they have to reevaluate what that looks like.
Do you think it's still possible to reach the target of below 2 degrees, let alone the 1.5 degree?
I think it is just about possible to hold 2 degrees C of warming. But let's also be clear that 2 degrees C of warming is a global average. So we have to be clear that 2 degrees centigrade of warming will be dangerous, if not deadly, for some people around the world. And we shouldn't see it as a safe threshold. But that's, I think, now about the best that we can hope for. I think the 1.5 degrees centigrade, unless we're incredibly lucky with these new technologies which don't yet exist, negative emission technologies, which we hope will suck the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere in the future, unless they work, and no one really thinks they're going to work at huge scale, then I think 1.5 degrees centigrade is no longer viable. And I find that really quite depressing to say that, because many people would benefit if we could stay at 1.5 rather than 2 degrees centigrade. So all I can do is I can say, you know, have my deepest apologies and sympathy, and the West should have done much more.
And so the 2 degree target isn't even possible with renewables alone?
Well, I certainly not alone. I mean, the interesting thing is that people think that these things are just about the supply of energy. They're also about the demand for energy. Now, this is a huge venue here, this big international negotiation. You come here, there are these huge tents put up with structures everywhere and lights and screens on. I left here at 10 o'clock the other night. All the lights, all the screens were on. I've been powered by coal-fired power station in Germany. So there are plenty of things that we can do that would dramatically reduce our energy consumption. And if you reduce the energy consumption significantly, if we electrify much more of our energy demand, and currently only about 20% of the energy we use is actually electricity, 80% of it is not electricity. It's our cars, it's our sometimes our heating, it's our flying, our ships and so forth. We may have to make much more of that electric. And then I think you can probably just about hold to 2 degrees centigrade of warming. But it doesn't mean we have to dramatically reduce our energy demand and significantly increase our penetration of renewables and other low carbon energy options. The one that people don't like to name is nuclear. It cannot solve the problems, but it might have a role to play. It's certainly low carbon, but it has lots of other issues and problems with it, of course.
Do you think negative emissions technologies have a role to play in our future towards a decarbonised world?
Well, they're already having a role, even though they don't exist. But I reckon that role is not a good role. I mean, they're already undermining real mitigation, real reductions in emissions.
So they're just a distraction?
At the moment, they're a huge distraction from what we should be doing. That's not to say that we shouldn't be researching them. I think we need to be seriously considering the nets, but I think we have to mitigate emissions as if they do not work. They probably will not work at anything like the scale that's assumed in the models that we use to advise governments. And I think that's the danger start. We're already using these models to undermine taking real action today. So negative emissions, yes to researching them. Do I think they'll work at scale? I think it's incredibly unlikely, but we should research them and find out. If we genuinely mitigated for 2 degrees C of warming, that would be pretty dramatic, but I think is possible, and very successful negative emissions. You put the two together, you've got an outside chance of 1.5 degrees C of warming.
Are you optimistic about our future, and do we stand a chance?
I don't like to think I'm optimistic or pessimistic. I think I'm just realistic. I think the chances of failure are about 95%. I think we're going to go, in the British expression, to hell in a handcart. But that 5% isn't just a random chance. That 5% is a choice. We can choose to succeed. And when I mean we, I do not mean necessarily great and good leaders. I do not mean all the climate glitterati and all the scientists that arrive here, or the journalists for that matter. What I mean is that society at large, so the people who are listening to this, they can drive significant change. So when people make changes in their school or in their workplace or down their sports club or whatever, those things might percolate through and become bigger changes. And then policymakers see those, or companies might see those and say, well, that's a good idea. How do I scale this up? Change is generally, you know, bottom up. And then eventually the people at the top supposedly see these changes and then scale them up. So it's a partnership between bottom up and top down. So it is not the responsibility of great leaders, if such things ever exist. It's the responsibility of all of us to try to drive these changes.
How long do we have?
Realistically, unless we're starting to come in down very rapidly in the next 3 or 4 years, and I do mean very rapidly indeed, then I think we will have failed on 2 degrees centigrade of warming. So we have a handful of years to make some very rapid and radical changes. We know what we need to do. We know it's all of our responsibility to engage with this. It's not just the great and good leaders. In fact, they've failed so far. So we have everything at our fingertips to solve this problem. We choose to fail so far, but we could choose to succeed.
That was climate scientist Kevin Anderson. They're talking about the world's carbon budget and the huge decarbonisation challenge that lies ahead. And that wraps up our final show here at the UN Climate Talks. This episode was produced with the help of Eliana Giaducci, Christoph Gruber and Gianni Di Biase. I'm Charlotte Lomas. Bye for now.